By the time Lucy caught up with Dan, he'd already found his way onto the captain's bridge of the starship Titanic. The main feature of the bridge was, as the journalist had tried to point out to them, the distinct lack of anyone or anything who could in any shape or form be referred to as captain. In fact, there was a distinct lack in any shape or form of anyone at all. "Jesus, what do we do now?" murmured Dan, as Lucy clutched onto his arm. Along the length of the bridge was a row of windows showing the great black immensity of space and the dazzling arm of the Milky Way along which they were headed. On the console beneath the windows were various display screens with associated controls. The first screen showed a series of random blocks falling from the top of the screen to the bottom. The second appeared to be some sort of racing track. A third was a shoot-'em-up, and the next one along was a game apparently based on the starship itself.
"Hey, they're all video games!"
Lucy felt righteously indignant.
"They aren't controls at all!"
As a matter of fact, the entire captain's bridge was little more than a high-class amusement arcade. It had been designed specifically to keep the captain of the starship Titanic amused during the tedium of long intergalactic flights in a spacecraft that was almost entirely automated and self-running. It was, after all, Titania, at the heart of the ship's intelligence, who was far more capable of taking decisions and issuing orders than any mere living creature.
"So," said Dan.
"So," said Lucy, "I suppose we'd better find out how to fly this baby ourselves and point her earthwards."
"So what was going on between you and that thing?"
"He's not a thing. He's just a perfectly ordinary alien, and there was nothing going on."
"He had his hands on your breasts."
"No, he did not."
Lucy couldn't stand Dan at moments like this.
Why couldn't he give her room? Why did he try and twist everything? What mattered was them, Lucy and Dan.
"What matters is us," said Lucy, taking her cue from the previous sentence.
"You and me and any other life form you can get off with."
"Oh, Jesus, Dan, you are so unpleasant."
"I'm merely stating the facts."
"Well, if you really want to know the facts, I never made love to Jürgen Zenzendorf."
"I wasn't talking about Jürgen Zenzendorf."
Trust Lucy, thought Dan, to bring up another case that she could defend instead of the one they were actually talking about.
"I never even suspected you of going to bed with Jürgen Zenzendorf. I mean, Jürgen Zenzendorf was an asshole."
"He was not. That's typical of you to denigrate my friends just because you are unbelievably, maniacally jealous."
Lucy was firing on all cylinders. Dan beat a hasty retreat.
Okay, I accept what you say about Jürgen. He was a nice guy. I liked him. I liked his moth collection. I liked his mother. Jürgen was great."
"Or Jimmy Clark."
"Ah, now I know you're lying."
"How can you say that?"
"Jimmy Clark told me himself you'd been to bed together."
"He's a lying bastard."
"Anyway, that was before I knew you. I don't want to talk about any of this."
"Then why'd you start it?"
Lucy was now yelling at the top of her voice. Dan found his drive to do whatever it was he'd previously felt driven to do shrivel into a limp rag of confusion. He'd actually forgotten what they'd started arguing about.
"Oh, Dan."
Lucy threw her arms round him.
"Why are you always so far away?"
"I'm here, Lucy."
"But I never seem to get through to you. I love you."
"And I love you," replied Dan,
and he kissed her, and she felt how far away he really was.
"Oh, Dan, let's get married."
"Oh, sure. We're on an alien spaceship, God knows how many light years from Earth, and you want to organize a wedding."
"Well, you know what I mean," she said.
"It's no good rushing these things."
"Dan, we've been living together for 13 years. We can't ever rush anything now."
"Let's get the hotel up and running, and then we can talk about it," said Dan sensibly.
"You do like the rectory?"
"Of course I do. I'm crazy about it."
"Except that it doesn't exist anymore."
"We'll get it rebuilt. Nigel got a great deal on selling off Top 10 Travel. We'll rebuild it better than it was and make it the best little hotel in the goddamn world."
"If we ever get back."
"Ah, if we ever get back," agreed Dan.
They looked round at the so-called Captain's Bridge, with its library, its video collection, its chessboards and card tables, its jacuzzi, billiard tables, cinema complex and gym, and they wondered how the hell they were ever going to find out how to control something that didn't appear to have any controls in the first place.
"Lucy," said Dan.
"Oh, don't start again. He wasn't doing anything."
"I wasn't talking about that," replied Dan. Good, retorted Lucy, 1 point scored.
You know this video game that seems to be based on the starship itself?
Uh-huh. Lucy was staring out of the windows above the console of games.
Well, it's sort of changing.
I know this is stupid, said Lucy, but you don't suppose that that computer game isn't a computer game?
You mean it might be an actual display showing those things coming towards us?
By now, Dan was also looking out of the window. A squadron of small, clumsy-looking spacecraft were hurtling towards the starship. Dan checked. Their movements correlated exactly to the motion of the spacecraft on the video display.
Oh, my God, murmured Lucy. We're being attacked.
At that moment, the journalist suddenly burst onto the captain's bridge.
The ship's on automatic, he panted, but the Central Intelligence Corps is missing some of its parts. We can't control the ship unless we can locate all the missing bits of the system and get them back into place.
Too late, said Lucy, and nodded out of the window. The starship was now entirely surrounded by the smaller spacecraft. The journalist muttered, Holy pangolin! A voice suddenly boomed over the ship's loudspeaker system.
You are surrounded! Give up at once, or we open fire!
Quick, yelled Dan, pushing the journalist over to the console.
How do we give up at once?
I haven't the slightest idea, returned the journalist.
If you refuse to give up, we shall open fire in 30 innings, said the voice from the enemy space fleet.
We give up, yelled Lucy.
But her voice merely echoed round the captain's bridge.
Do something, screamed Dan.
I told you, the ship's missing essential bits. I don't know what to do.
The journalist was flipping controls as fast as he could, but to little effect.
Since you refuse to cooperate, boomed the voice.
We'll cooperate, just give us a chance!
Lucy had climbed onto the console and was waving her arms at the spaceships in a desperate attempt to attract their attention.
You give us no choice but to open fire.
The space outside the starship suddenly exploded in light, and a terrific noise battered the mighty hull, deafening those inside. Lucy fell off the console, and Dan and the journalist both dived to the floor, where they lay trembling with their hands over their ears. There was then a pause. The voice boomed over the loudspeaker again.
Do you surrender?
Yes, yes, we surrender, screamed all three occupants of the captain's bridge.
Very well, you leave us no choice.
Another almighty din broke out around the starship, and this time they could feel it shudder with the impact of the explosions outside. Then there was silence. The smaller spacecraft edged in a little closer. Then the voice was booming out again.
Look, we don't want to damage the starship, but if you refuse to cooperate, you'll leave us no choice.
The journalist had by this time found a sort of microphone. He pushed a switch and bellowed into it.
Stop! Stop! We surrender! Stop!
His voice boomed out all over the starship Titanic. There was a terrible silence. Then they heard the enemy for the last time.
We shall hold you responsible for any damage done to the starship.
With that, a wave of the smaller spacecraft peeled off from the main fleet and swooped towards the starship. Points of light spattered out from their guns, and the sound of ripping metal shook the great starship.
Oh, my God! Screamed Lucy.
None of them could have told you how long the attack went on for, but it seemed like several lifetimes to the three figures huddled on the captain's bridge. The noise, the vibration, the crashing and bucking of the giant starship went on and on. Lucy found the journalist had his hands on her breast, but decided not to say anything. When it was all over, they waited and then stood up, trembling and shaking. The first wave was returning to the main fleet. Meanwhile, a second wave was peeling off.
Here they come again, yelled Dan.
And he and Lucy ducked down once more beneath the console. But the journalist remained standing with a curious expression on his face. Lucy and Dan braced themselves for the gunfire, but it didn't come. Instead, there was an odd, rather unmartial banging on the hull of the ship.
Yassikins, muttered the journalist.
Lucy and Dan both assumed this was another alien expletive and remained under cover. But then the journalist nudged Dan and said, Look. Dan cautiously put his head above the console and peered out of the window. The second wave of spaceships had pulled up all around the starship, and an army of short and stocky, space-suited figures were swarming over the hull, hammering and welding as they went.
What the blazes? Asked Dan.
They're repairing the damage, explained the journalist.
The Atticans are like that. They hate injuring hardware.
And what about software? Asked Lucy, readjusting her bra.
We'll need guns, yelled the journalist. Follow me. The three of them ran, doubled up, out of the captain's bridge, while the enemies, hammering and welding outside, gathered in intensity. Meanwhile, the voice boomed out over the loudspeakers again.
We shall recommence our attack as soon as the first damage has been repaired. If you do not surrender, we shall board and dispose of everyone we find.
In the crew's quarters, the journalist discovered an arms cache. He handed out weapons to Dan and Lucy.
How do we use them? Asked Dan, turning a strange gun over in his hand.
It had a short thingy and bulbous side thingies and a sort of thingy that stuck out and which Dan pushed. A laser beam shot across the crew room and exploded in a fireball at the other end.
Like that, explained the journalist, except don't point them at the soft furnishings.
He rushed over to the flaming curtain that Dan had just set on fire and grabbed an extinguisher.
Hey, we can't use these, cried Lucy.
Then you'll just have to get used to the idea of being thrown off the ship into deep space. These Yasgans are not playing games. Here, Dan, put this on. He threw Dan a helmet.
What is it? Asked Dan.
The starship has two realities, explained the journalist. One is the data side, and the other is the matter side. When the Yasgans board, they'll try to take over the data side as well as the matter side. So one of us better be prepared to confront them there.
I've no clue what you're talking about, replied Dan.
It's a VR helmet, a virtual reality helmet. You put it on, you'll be able to explore the data side and check whatever the Yasgans get up to there. The journalist was clearly losing patience.
I'll just put it on, shouted Lucy.
The noise from the repairs on the hull was getting unbearable.
What the heck are they doing out there, exclaimed Dan.
Just put on the helmet, cried Lucy, at which Dan did.
Oh, wow, he exclaimed. I see what you mean. I'm right in the ship. Hey, this is great. I can get into the consoles. Wow, now I'm running along the wiring. Hey, the circuit boards are like vast cities. Oh, shit.
The moment he had the helmet on, the journalist grabbed Lucy and started kissing her as if there was no tomorrow, which he figured might well be the case. And as if she'd been expecting this all along, Lucy started to kiss him. But then she suddenly pulled back and glanced anxiously over at Dan, who was climbing some invisible stairs in his virtual reality, and then turning around and handling invisible objects and letting out delighted yelps.
Oh, don't worry about him, panted the journalist. He can't hear or see us. We're still matter-side. He'll be totally absorbed in that thing. It's always the same. First time you put on one of those, you're usually off for 5 or 6 hours. Let's do it.
But still Lucy pushed him away.
But what about the Yasgans, she protested. They're invading the ship. That's right. We've hardly got time to do it before they arrived. Quick!
Is that all you can think about? Groaned Lucy. The journalist was now nuzzling her neck and sending excited shivers down her spine.
I told you, once we Blerontinian males get aroused.
Ah!
Lucy suddenly screamed.
And what about the bomb?
Oh, pangolin! Exclaimed the journalist. I'd forgotten about that. He suddenly whipped a small handset out of one of his many pockets and flipped it on.
25, 24, 23, the bomb was counting.
Toothless rabbits, yelled the journalist. It's nearly there.
22, said the bomb.
Hey, bomb, yelled the journalist into the phone.
Oh, don't talk to me, moaned the bomb. I'm nearly there. 23, no, I've done that.
We're being invaded, shouted the journalist.
20, oh, no, oh, damn. Oh, recommencing countdown. 1,000.
The journalist flipped the phone off and started kissing Lucy's neck and undoing her suit.
Whew, that was close, he breathed.
Whoops, nearly went down a transistor then, said Dan.
And suddenly Lucy was running her hands all over the journalist and pulling him down onto the floor.
You're crazy, she murmured.
The hammering and banging on the outside of the ship had stopped by the time Lucy and the journalist had struggled back into their clothes. Dan, who was still scrambling around some unseen obstacles on the data side, suddenly yelled out,
"They're in the ship!"
The journalist grabbed as many weapons as he could carry and headed out of the crew room. Down at the far end of the Grand Axial Canal, he could see short, stocky figures already slipping onto the jetty. The journalist settled himself behind a large podium on which one of the braziers burnt and took aim. As Lucy joined him, he fired and a series of explosions rocked the jetty and sent the invaders diving for cover. The next moment, Lucy felt the air around and above her exploding with light and noise as the Yasgans returned their fire.
Hey, this air duct goes on forever!
Lucy span round to see that Dan, still in the VR helmet and totally unconscious of anything that was happening matterside, had wandered out through the open door of the crew room and was now heading straight for the Grand Axial Canal. "Dan!" she screamed, and ran towards him as his feet reached the edge of the embankment. Immediately there was another explosion of noise and light around them as the Yassikans fired again. But Lucy had hold of Dan's sleeve. She managed to twist him round on the very edge of the water and pushed him back towards the crew room. The journalist, meanwhile, was firing as fast as he could in the general direction of the invaders. But by now there was so much smoke neither side could see very much. "Let's get out of here!" yelled the journalist, and he bundled Lucy after Dan back into the crew room.
"Who set fire to the curtains?" demanded Bolfast the moment he burst into the crew room.
He nodded, and a couple of Yassikan repair workers hurried over to replace them. Bolfast had led his special assault group along a back service corridor to the crew's quarters, while Yelin and Asmal led the frontal attack along the main arteries of the starship. Bolfast loved the finish they had obtained on the service corridor ceiling. It gave him much quiet satisfaction in the dark of the night to reflect on the craftsmanship and the high quality of material lavished on even the working areas of the great starship.
"Never was there another such construction in the entire history of our people," he used to tell his grandchildren as they sat around the evening hearth eating their dumpling stew and snort crackling. "Even the curtains in the crew rooms were woven from the hair of the silky Canadil, which lives high up in the mountains of Maelor and can only be caught with love and kindness. The hair of the Canadil is so fine you must only weave it by the light of the moons, for in sunlight it will disappear like snow." The children loved these tales of craftsmanship and daring feats of engineering. It cut Bolfast to the quick to see how someone could mistreat such soft furnishings. In fact, it made him very cross indeed. At that very moment, a figure wearing a VR helmet stumbled into the room, followed by two others, one of whom was clearly a treacherous Blerontinian. A black rage swallowed Bolfast whole, and the next moment he had swiveled out his SD handgun and blasted the three newcomers to cosmic dust. Their bodies exploded in a supernova of entrails and mangled flesh that quickly reached white heat and, happily, burnt out before they could besmatter or stain the beautifully hand-lacquered walls. Lucy was aware of a violent cacophony of noise, and her eyes were whited out by the most piercing light. She screamed, grabbed onto the journalist, and fell in a faint upon the floor. It was that terrifying. Bolfast grinned and blew away the smoke from his SD handgun. His anger assuaged, he twirled the gun on his finger and slipped it back into its holster. It has to be explained at this point that the Yassikans were a peace-loving, kindly race, dedicated to craftsmanship and sober industry. Many of them, however, were also prone to blind, bloodlusting rage when confronted by certain things, such as a disregard for fine workmanship. In the distant past, these rages had led to terrible destruction of life and property, and since the moods went as quickly as they came, they had also led to unendurable remorse for many thousands of these otherwise benign and caring folk. The Yassikan scientists had, therefore, developed the SD weapon, which, unlike the sort of hardware that most military scientists come up with, was designed to reduce death and destruction rather than increase it. The simulated destruction weapon, or SD gun, gave the user the momentary impression of having wreaked the bloody revenge that his crazed fury craved, without actually doing any damage. It always surprised and stunned the enemy, but that was all. Lucy, not knowing any of this, was more than astonished to find herself still alive enough to hear the leader of the invaders demand, "You are under arrest. Where are the others?" "Hey, this is great. I'm going down one of the cybernautic neural pathways. It's like a water slide. Way excellent!" exclaimed Dan. "Take that stupid thing off his head," snapped Bolfast.
The Yassikans had no time for virtual reality exercises. Their business was exclusively matterside. Two of the invaders grabbed Dan and yanked the helmet off his head.
"Hey, I was enjoying that. Jeepers, what's going on?"
said Dan as he experienced SRM, sudden return to matterside.
"I said, where are the others?" repeated Bolfast.
"There aren't any others," replied the journalist truculently.
"Come on, I wasn't brought up in a Blerontinian state nursery. Who's running this ship?"
Blerontinian state nurseries were infamous for turning out individuals of less than average mental agility, possibly owing to the fact that, for generations, Blerontinian governments had saved money on these establishments by forbidding any teaching to be done in them. Bolfas was getting irritated again. He'd just noticed the wretched finish on the mess tables. It had totally let down the high standards set by his own workmen on the other fittings in the crew room. Whoever had supplied the tables had used unseasoned linten pine from northern Blerontin, an inferior wood, which would warp badly after a couple of decades in use. And, by the falls of Fachnik, they hadn't even concealed the end grain with housed joints. In fact, when he looked closer, he could see the tenons were barely haunched, leaving scarcely enough timber at the top of the stile for wedging. Had these people never learned even the most rudimentary basics of the art of joinery? Bolfas reached for his SD gun. But before he could wreak his terrible and destructive revenge on the perpetrators of this slipshod botchwork, a miracle happened. The door of the crew room opened, and a vision entered. Someone so compellingly and so unutterably beautiful that Bolfas fell heavily and permanently in love. His life was never to be the same from that moment forth. He lowered the SD gun and stared in childlike adoration. Nettie, who had just completed her course of rejuvenation in Leovinus's extraordinary beauty parlour, had not only regained her youthful complexion, her body had also returned to its former proportions. In fact, if anything, her waist was just that little bit thinner, her breasts just a tiny bit firmer, the swell of her stomach just a tad more rounded. She looked more lovely than ever, for despite the fresh bloom of youth that had returned to her cheeks, her face was also suffused with the wisdom that comes of having lived for several million light-years. Old Leovinus certainly knew what he was doing.
"Nettie," murmured Dan.
"Who'd you say?" asked Bolfas absent-mindedly. "Hi, everybody," said Nettie. "Supposing we all introduce ourselves. I'm Nettie."
"Captain Bolfas, at your service," said Bolfas, springing to attention. "And these are Corporals Yarktak, Edinbop, Raguliten, Dezembo, Luntpaga, Forzap, Kakit, Zimwiddy, Dutaprat, Kazintinker Riggipittle, Persen Hacken, Roof Cleetop, Spangler Widden, Buke Hammerdorf, Bunsley Water, Brudel Hampton, Harsey Waddle, Unctimpota, Gol Hollywell, Dinsey Newt, Tiddleoff, Cosimiwit, Wan Crocodile, Urkel Hameldrat, Inchby Wiglet, Samuel Liftoff, Buke Willy Nudget, he's a half cousin by marriage of Buke Hammerdorf."
"Hi, Nettie," said one of the Yassican invaders.
"Barnes Apute," continued Bolfas, "Spig Halliwiller, Memziportim, Itkip, Harlow Freyta, Pulligit, Beakle Mensdork, Apple Saftat, Buck Humster, Rintin Eaglebun, Bootintuck, Poodle Asvan, Sub Cretor Cattlebird."
"Look, I hate to interrupt," interrupted the journalist, "but there's a bomb on board this ship which is about to go off in..." He switched on the mobile phone.
10, 9, counted the bomb.
"Hot pangling!" exclaimed the journalist.
"Silence, Blerontinian purveyor of shoddy goods!" shouted Bolfas, grabbing the mobile phone.
"He's not a purveyor of shoddy goods!" exclaimed Lucy,
who, if the truth were told, was a bit hacked off by the reaction to Nettie's entrance.
8, said the bomb.
"Give me that!"
screamed the journalist, flinging himself at the phone. Bolfas tossed it to Corporal Inchby Wiglet.
7, counted the bomb.
"It's down to 7, yelled the journalist.
"Take this Blerontinian bodger to the cells," commanded Bolfas.
Corporals Spangler Widden and Rintin Eaglebun grabbed the journalist in a half-Nelson and marched him out of the crew room.
6, said the bomb,
and Corporal Inchby Wiglet flicked the mobile phone off.
"These two as well,"
Bolfas was pointing at Lucy and Dan.
"No," cried Lucy and Dan, "the bomb!"
But they were hustled out. "Captain Bolfas," said Nettie in a cool voice, "there is no time to explain. Please give me the phone."
"I am afraid I cannot allow you to use it, Nettie," said Captain Bolfas, "for security reasons."
"Such as?"
"Ah, you might call for reinforcements."
"Captain Bolfas, you have my word that there is no one else on this ship as far as I know. You also have my word that there is a bomb about to blow us all to cosmic dust unless you give me that phone." Bolfas hesitated for a fraction of a second and then nodded to Corporal Inchby Wiglet. Corporal Inchby Wiglet hesitated even less than a fraction of a second and handed the phone to Nettie. Nettie switched it on.
2, said the bomb.
"Oh, bomb," said Nettie. "This is Nettie, remember me?"
1, said the bomb.
How many fours make eight? No, no. How many fours make eight?
Two, said the bomb.
How many twos in six?
Three, said the bomb.
And how many times does three go into 12?
Four, said the bomb.
It paused for a moment and then continued.
Five. Six. Seven.
Phew, said Nettie, that'll buy a bit of time.
Why have you put this bomb onto our ship? Demanded Bolfas.
Your ship, exclaimed Nettie.
Why do you sound so surprised? Cried Bolfas. Do you think we're not smart enough to have built such a wonderful thing?
Oh, no, no, replied Nettie. I didn't mean anything like that. It's just that you attacked the ship. It didn't seem like you owned it.
Of course we own it.
Nettie thought Captain Bolfas appeared a trifle defensive.
Legally and morally, this ship is our rightful recompense for all the misery and hardships that we have suffered at the hands of the Blerontinians.
Look, I don't want to appear stupid.
Oh, you could never look that, Nettie, the captain assured her.
Well, thank you.
Nettie felt herself charmed by this short, fair stranger, in whose hands her fate apparently lay.
But I don't know the background history to all this.
And I will be delighted to tell you the whole story, dear lady.
Bolfas gave her a deep bow.
But first, it is my unpleasant task to ask you once again, why have you placed a bomb on this ship?
We haven't.
Nettie gave a little laugh that sent the captain's heart reeling after his wobbly knees.
We're on this ship by accident.
And she told Bolfas the whole story. How Dan and Lucy were about to turn the old rectory into a hotel with the money from the Top Ten Travel Agency. And how the starship had crashed into the house. How they had been invited aboard by a polite robot. And of all the things that had passed on the ship up until the invasion by the good captain's forces. When she had finished, there was a long pause until Nettie eventually added, And that's it, really. Bolfas seemed to suddenly recollect himself, as if he'd been in a dream while she'd been talking. He jumped to attention and clicked his heels in a most courteous manner.
I understand perfectly, dear lady, he said, bowing and kissing her hand.
Captain Bolfas increasingly looked as if he'd just stepped out of a Jane Austen novel.
All we want to do is get back to Earth, said Nettie.
Of course.
Captain Bolfas clicked his heels again, in that way that made Nettie wriggle inside with delight.
I am entirely at your service. Come.
And Nettie followed the captain, her high heels clicking on the beautifully laid floor of the work area. Dan wasn't quite sure why he was surprised to find that there were cells on the starship Titanic. It made sense in a way, he supposed, and yet they seemed totally out of place amidst all this luxury and elegance. The cell that he and the journalist had been thrown into was, as cells tend to be, bare and cold. It was also damp, which is certainly what you'd expect cells to be, but a bit surprising on such a technologically advanced vehicle.
Oh, Lucy is such a good fuck, said the journalist, shaking his head in admiration. You're a lucky man.
Look, said Dan, I hate to disabuse you, but on Earth our attitude to these sort of things is not the same as you Blerontinians.
Poh, you're telling me, exclaimed the journalist. When Lucy first suggested we have sex, I could hardly believe my ears.
She did what? Exclaimed Dan.
Well, we thought that the bomb was going to explode at any second, and she just kind of... Hey, come to think of it, do you think your other friend, what's her name?
She suggested you make love.
The blonde one, Nighty.
Nettie.
Do you think Nettie knows about talking to the bomb?
I don't believe Lucy suggested you make love, replied Dan.
That was when I first realized how different sexual attitudes must be on your planet, replied the journalist.
Dan went a bit quiet. In all the years he'd known Lucy, and what was it? Oh, it must be all of 13 years now, probably more since they'd been travelling at the speed of light. And in all those years, he couldn't remember Lucy initiating a single sexual act. In the early days, he would sometimes lie awake at night, waiting to see if she would start, but he finally gave up. She was always perfectly happy to make love, but he just had to make the first approach. He'd always assumed that that was just how she was.
Hey, jailer! The journalist was yelling out of the bars. There! Is that you?
Lucy's voice came from the cell down the row.
Lucy! Cried the journalist. Pipes of pangolin! I want to screw the arse off you!
Stop it! Screamed Dan, and he threw himself at the journalist.
The two of them rolled around the sodden floor of their cell, with Dan punching and kicking, and the surprised journalist trying to defend himself.
Dan! Dan, is that you?
Lucy was yelling. She could hear them fighting.
Stop that! We've got to save our strength! We've got to get out of here! Lucy's right,
the journalist panted. And suddenly the fight went out of Dan. Suddenly he found himself wondering why he was so jealous.
Why did you attack me? Asked the journalist.
Dan was just about to explain the history of sexual mores on Earth when he stopped himself.
Look, let's just call a truce. Just don't talk about sex for the rest of the day, all right?
Well, if you'd rather. But don't worry about me. I mean, I'm not shocked by the laxity of your Earth mores.
Just shut up about it for a few minutes.
Okay, replied the journalist.
Now, said Dan, suppose you tell me everything you know about this starship that we're all stuck on, and then maybe together we can figure a way to get off it.
Dan, I love you, shouted Lucy from her cell.
I love you too, Dan shouted back.
Me too, shouted the journalist.
Dan fought back the urge to hit him and said,
Tell me what you know.
And so the journalist told Dan about how the construction of the starship Titanic had bankrupted the planet of Yasica, and how Starstruck Inc. had then removed the construction work without paying their debts. He told Dan of the rumours of financial trouble that had dogged the building of the ship on Blorontin, of the suspected shoddy workmanship of the unmarried teenage mothers employed on the work, and how corners had been cut. He told Dan of Leovinus, the architect, engineer, artist, composer, and greatest general all-round genius in the galaxy, and how he had met him on the night before the launch. He told Dan of his meeting with Scraliontis, the accountant, who had told him of the bomb and the plot to scuttle the great starship and claim the insurance, shortly before plunging to his death after being attacked by a parrot. The journalist then told Dan how, despite his wounds, he had decided to stow away on board in order to get the great scoop that had always hitherto eluded him in his career as a journalist. He'd expose the full story behind the construction of the starship, and, at the same time, give a first-hand account of what it was like to be the only passenger on board. The idea had been to launch the ship on automatic before flying her to Dormilion, where she was to pick up her first crew and passengers. The journalist then told Dan about how the ship had suffered a SMEF, spontaneous massive existence failure, shortly after launch, and how it had crash-landed on some unknown planet in the unexplored backside of the galaxy. He finally described how, after the crash, he had heard cries coming from one of the curtains in the first-class dining room. He had then discovered Leovinus, where he'd been bound and left for dead by Scraliontis. The journalist had freed him, and then tried to stop the old man from rushing off the ship, but to no avail. Despite his age, Leovinus had overpowered him, the journalist was still losing blood at this stage, and, screaming for revenge, waving a glowing silver shard in his hand, and presumably imagining he was still on Blorontin, the great genius had disappeared into the darkness of an alien world.
Captain Balthas wants to see you.
Their jailer suddenly cut across the long story. He jangled his keys as he opened the door to the wretched cell and pulled the journalist out. Captain Balthas had escorted the beautiful Nettie to the captain's bridge. There, he had invited her to take a little tea and some cinnamon biscuit, while he made the necessary arrangements to fly the great starship back to the planet Earth.
Without wishing to sound disrespectful, he explained to her, it is not a planet with which I am familiar, though, of course, it must be the most delightful world to be the home of someone as lovely and charming as yourself.
He bowed, and Nettie felt the thrill of being treated like the heroine of Northanger Abbey.
I'm sure you're more than capable of guiding us home, she said, lowering her eyes.
Ah, my dear lady, exclaimed the captain,
it is not I who will guide the ship, but the ship itself.
The exact location of the planet Earth will have been recorded in the starship's Central Intelligence Corps. Although none of us have any idea of where your planet is to be found, all I have to do is tell Titania, that is what Leovinus named his cybernautic system, and she will relocate it and take us there.
Captain Balthas pressed a small button in one of the consoles next to a video game based on a recent Blerontinian film, and that is where the novel suddenly ceased to be won by Jane Austen or even Catherine Cookson.
Bath, Farthingarth! Exclaimed Balthas. I'm getting no response.
Nettie, who had felt the Earth and home to be very close indeed, a mere button push away, now saw it suddenly recede into deep space.
Captain Balthas!
Corporal Buke Willie Nudgett, the cousin by marriage of Corporal Buke Hammerdorf, had just arrived, out of breath and nervous.
The Central Intelligence Corps! Someone's removed the vital functions!
Balthas turned to Yelin, who was busy with one of the shoot-'em-up games.
This is the work of that Blerontinian vandal. Bring him up at once.
By the time the journalist was thrown at his feet, Bolfas had become quite angry. Not as angry as if he had known about the substandard materials used for the railing around the central well, or if he had known about the scandalous lack of finish in the bilge and rubbish disposal wastes, where the unmarried teenage mothers had been told not to rub down or even varnish, but still pretty angry.
"What have you done to Titania's brain?" he roared.
The journalist stuck out his chin and said, "I can only give you my name, rank, and number."
"This isn't the Great Escape," exclaimed Bolfas, swivelling a light into the journalist's eyes. "Tell me what you know, or I shall let Horst here do his worst."
The Great Escape is the name of a famous Blerontin film celebrating the true story of how the cream of the Blerontinian space fleet, held prisoners in the supposedly impregnable fortress of Drat Krona, contrived a mass escape. Oddly enough, it also starred Steve McQueen.
"My lips are sealed," countered the journalist, turning his head away.
"Very well, you leave me no choice," snarled Bolfas, and he struck the journalist across the face with his leather glove.
"All right," said the journalist. "I'll tell you anything you want, anything." "Don't you want to be tortured a little more first?" "No, I'd rather tell you now."
"Oh, very well.
We know you've sabotaged Titania's brain to prevent us returning to Yassica. Tell us what you've done with the parts."
The journalist looked surprised. "Scratleontis didn't tell me about that part of the plot."
"What plot?"
Bolfas secretly admired his Blerontinian adversary for his ability to remain cool under circumstances when a lesser man would have cracked. "It's a pity," he thought, "we aren't fighting this war on the same side. On the other hand, we're not actually fighting a war at all."
Bolfas made an effort to pull himself together.
The journalist then told everything he knew about Scraliontis's and Bobostigan's plot to scuttle the great starship and claim the insurance. Bolfas listened in white-faced anger. Nettie could see the rage boiling up within him.
"It's not this fellow's fault," she cried out.
Bolfas hesitated. His hand was already on his SD gun, but something in the tone of Nettie's voice stilled the fury inside him. He left his gun alone.
"They were on the ship the night before the launch," said the journalist. "They wouldn't have wanted to attract attention by going in and out of it, so I imagine whatever they took out of the central intelligence system, they'll have hidden somewhere on board."
"Sounds feasible," said Asmal, the other Yassican commander, who up to this point had been doing fantastically well at the Tetris game. "Very well," said Bolfas. "We will search the ship from prow to keel. Those parts must be found, or we will never get Nettie back to her own planet. Indeed, we will find it hard enough to limp back to Yassica as it is."
"I think we can make it, Captain," said Rodin, the navigational engineer. "We are in the Starius Zone ED-3278 of the Proxima Betrial section of the Inner Galaxy. I can get us home by dead reckoning, so long as Asmal can get manual control of the ship's power."
Asmal nodded.
"I have control now of enough functions to be able to steer, but it will be a long trip."
And so the great starship Titanic turned its vast bulk in the star-bright darkness of space and began its weary journey back to the planet of Yassica. The search for the missing parts of the starship's brain proved more difficult than anyone could have anticipated. This was mainly owing to the fact that the ship's robots were becoming increasingly eccentric in their behaviour. The doorbots were beginning to hallucinate, opening doors for non-existent first-class passengers' pets, and being charming to waste disposal units. The liftbots had gone into a permanent decline, convinced that the only way to avoid the end of civilization as they knew it was to eat less protein. The dustbots kept dashing out from the skirting after bits of fluff that weren't there, and tripping everybody up. But the biggest problem was in the main bar of the ship, where the barbot was trapped into some strange cyber-psychotic loop, despite the fact that they could all clearly see a piece of Titania's brain amongst the coloured glasses and bottles on the shelf behind him.
"Yes, yes, sir, Jeff be with you. Cock this tail mix, have you just, sir?"
The barbot veered between the charmingly incomprehensible and the belligerently drunk.
"Just give us that piece of cyberware on the shelf there," cried Corporal Gull Hollywell,
but the barbot simply bit his nose.
"Ow!" cried Corporal Gull Hollywell.
Every attempt to climb over the bar and get at the object was met with a surprising show of force from the barbot, and the peace-loving Yassicans were forced into retreat.